My name is Susan Hexamer, and I work in the Office of Organizational and Staff Development, and I am simply delighted to see this group of staff, faculty, support staff, and administrators gathered to learn from and with Dr. Stephen Brookfield. And I'm delighted on so many levels, partly because he's such an accomplished researcher and scholar and writer, author of 15 books, six of which have won a very distinguished prize, the Cyril O. Poole World Award for Literature and Adult Education. Dr. Brookfield brings more than 40 years of experience as an educator, and as our keynote this morning said, she started when she was 12, so we'll give you that. You also bring considerable humility about your own travails as a learner, which I think is something many of us can relate to, I know I can. And you also offer us considerable inspiration. After 10 years at Columbia, as a professor of higher education, Dr. Brookfield was appointed as an endowed chair at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, Minnesota, St. Paul. But I wanted to tell you a bit about Dr. Brookfield's influence on something he's not aware of, is his influence on our learning culture here at George Brown College. And anyone who has completed faculty probation in the last few years can attest to the fact, and I'm looking for Jules. I know you're here somewhere. Jules is over there. Jules is our best convert from to reflective practice. About 8 years ago, there were 25 faculty sitting in Muskoka chairs at Geneva Park, and the translation for you is Adirondack chairs. And we were sinking deeply into reflective practice, holding your book on our lap. And we each read the first chapter of the book as a requirement for attending the retreat. And then we taught each other from doing a jigsaw, which teachers will know is a good way to teach students, get them to teach each other about the key concepts of the book. And we all became deeply reflective. And some reminded me that a few of us were deeply hungover the next day. Because it is a time for work and play. However, that really set the tone for reflective practice at George Brown College. And at a recent seminar for new faculty, one of our colleagues, he's not here today, and I'm sorry he's not, he brought rosemary plants to place on the table, one in front of my colleague Nikki and one in front of me, as we had about 15 people gathered around the table. And I know some of those people are here right now, and I think that you can attest to the fact, there's Joanne, she's waving her hand. I think that the rosemary had a very deep impact on our ability to reflect. And afterwards, I realized that lavender is for relaxation. A lot of us know that. But rosemary is for clarity of thought. And so our colleague, who is a chef, brought rosemary to sharpen our thinking, and we really, truly did sink into a very reflective space. And others who were at that meeting knew that they were going to have to keep an eye on me because this is Brookfield mania for me, so I'm really excited that you're here. Now that I've got that off my chest, I'll be fine. I just had to say it. I won't be stalking you. Don't worry. But I will make space for you to share your findings and a lot of your inspiration now. And thank you so much for doing the Ontario tour with us.
Great. Thank you. Thanks very much. Just a few things before I go into my more formal remarks. I wrote my homepage up on the screen. The URL is just my name, Stephen Brookfield, all one word, stephenbrookfield.com. And if I mention particular techniques, classroom activities, exercises, instruments, and so on today, you will find them on my homepage. You can go and download them for free. You don't need to ask my permission to use anything that you find up here. The best link is probably the workshop materials link, which is on the top right hand. If you click on that, it takes you to PDF files. Probably each of the PDF files contains 30 or so classroom instruments and exercises. So, you know, just steal from the homepage if, whoops, it seems to be appropriate. And so that's the first resource I wanted to mention. Then I have a Twitter feed up for the session today. The hashtag is TC5815. So if you have reactions and comments while I'm speaking, you would like to tweet those reactions and comments, when I've done the sort of first part of the session, we'll bring those up on the screen and see what you'd like me to address. So again, the Discover hashtag for the tweets is just hashtag TC5815. And then for those who don't know how to use Twitter, this is another great tool. Today's Meet, which you can set up 30 seconds before you start teaching a course. What you do is go to the Today's Meet website and just type in the name of the session for that day's meet. Today's meet that we have up here is Today's Meet Crit Ref. So if you want to raise a question, post a reaction, make a comment, if you don't want to use Twitter, just go to todaysmeet.com/CritRef. So I'm a big believer in circumventing speech in teaching. I feel that speech is privileged way too much. We need ways to bring in students who are quieter. International students for whom English is not the first language, people who need time to process and think. Introverts, so the Twitter and the Today's Meet pages are up for that reason. So let's move to the more formal part of the session. So what I'm going to do is say some things about critical reflection for about 45 minutes or so, and then we'll do a drawing for some books, and then we'll move into a conversation. Questions and reactions, disagreements, challenges, and so on. So I thought I should begin by defining my terms. So what is critical reflection? I think the core process in critical reflection is hunting assumptions, trying to find out whether the assumptions that we operate under make sense and fit the situations in which we find ourselves. And assumptions come from multiple sources, from experts and authorities, people who say this is how things should be done, who set the rules, the gatekeepers in any scholarly discipline, the accreditation agency, which is in charge with giving your institution the imprimatur that it's a legitimate enterprise. Then some assumptions come from more culturally intangible sources, broadly put, common sense. You just grow up with certain notions that this is the right way to do things, this is the right way to work with adults, this is the right way to create an inclusive classroom, and so on. Then there are codified sets of rules and ethics in some professions. There are very, very specific sets of rules, codes of practice that need to be followed, which are based on assumptions about what good professional practice looks like. And then, the thing that I'm particularly interested in, I think we get a lot of assumptions from examined experience, from looking at our experience in as inquisitive and critical way as we can, to work out from experience, when does an assumption make more sense or make less sense? And my own way of thinking about this is that there aren't that many assumptions, actually, that are either right or wrong. I think most assumptions fit better in some situations and don't seem to fit as well in others. So examined experience helps us work out, you know, does my assumption on how to raise my kids, the assumptions I have about which media commentators are telling me the truth, the assumptions that I have about how to construct a set list. If you play in a band, I play in a punk rock band in my other time when I'm not doing education called the 99ers. And by the way, 99ers, you can go to the 99ers from my homepage. We have 4 albums out on Spin Out Records. Spin Out is a label in Nashville, Tennessee, but we're not a country band. We play kind of punk rock slash rock and roll. So, when I'm in the band, there are lots of assumptions about the way to construct a set list. We make assumptions that the audience at this particular bar will want to hear more covers. Audience at this particular bar can tolerate a set mostly of originals. We have assumptions about the way we sequence songs, when we should slow things down to give ourselves and others a break, and so on and so forth. So, critical reflection really focuses on uncovering and examining assumptions. And when it comes to teaching and learning, I think the way that we uncover and check assumptions is by looking at our practice from multiple points of view, through multiple lenses. The 4 lenses that I'm really intrigued by are the lens of students' eyes. So, what do our students tell us about what works or what's getting in the way? The lens of colleagues' perceptions. I feel that for me as a teacher, when I have a problem, I immediately go to colleagues, trusted colleagues, and seek their advice. The lens of our own autobiographies as learners, I think the way we've experienced learning very much frames how we think about practice in our roles as educators, and we sort of try maybe and imitate those teachers that we admired, and we try and avoid the worst errors of those that were just awful. And then we look at relevant theory research as well. So these 4 lenses, these are some of the ways I think that we explore them. Students' eyes, we have various classroom assessment tools. The one that I like the most is called the Critical Incident Questionnaire. I'll say a little bit about that in a moment. It's an anonymous student evaluation tool that gets a sense of where people are each week. Colleagues' perceptions, I love team teaching because I always feel I have someone in the room who can give me an alternate reading of what's going on. I'm the kind of teacher who is hard on himself, and I feel like a complete imposter most of the time in my life, in my professional role. It's funny, I don't feel like an imposter when I'm in the band, but I really feel like an imposter, in educational settings. So I tend to leave class thinking, how can I have been so stupid? I really missed a great teachable moment there. The class just didn't engage and take off. And my co-teacher will often have a completely different read of it and point out things that went well and say, didn't you notice such and such? And I've already spoken about autobiography and theory and research. I've found theory to be incredibly helpful in understanding what's going on in my classrooms. The notion of working with a diverse student body, knowing a little bit about the racial and cultural traditions, knowing about the gumbo yaya interlapping speech of African American culture, knowing about the Confucian tradition with a reference to teacher experts in Southeast Asian culture, knowing about the importance of silence with indigenous cultures, knowing about the European reliance on logic and reason and thinking. All these things are help me have a different perspective on what's going on in my classroom. So why do all this? Well, for me, the reason to do reflective practice is basically to take informed actions. I want my actions as a teacher to hopefully work out the way that I intend them to work out. I want to feel when I choose to do certain things in class, to deal with certain situations in particular ways. I want to know that the way that I sequence curriculum really makes sense to students' learning rhythms. I want to know that the assessment procedures that I design really are measuring what I'm trying to get at. So I want to take informed actions as a teacher, and these are the three ways I think I would define an informed action. It's one that's based on evidence and experience that can be produced and has had its assumptions checked. It's one that you can explain to a colleague, you know, I'm doing this for these reasons, and it's one that stands a good chance of achieving its intended consequence. We will move into somewhat much more practical stuff in a moment. I think that when we engage in reflective practice and we try and uncover assumptions, there are typically three kinds of assumptions that are uncovered, and these are in descending order of frequency. So I think the most commonly uncovered assumptions are causal assumptions. Those are assumptions we have about cause and effect. So if I arrange the chairs in a circle in the classroom, rather than having rows of chairs, this will increase students' feeling of being in a democratic, student-centered environment. If I use a lot of autobiographical disclosure, this will create good connections to the subject. If I model critical thinking out loud, this will help my team to do the same. Prescriptive assumptions are about assumptions that we have about how things should happen, what a good teacher should do, what a good leader looks like, what a good meeting basically comprises. So, you know, a good teacher slash leader is critically reflective. Paradigmatic assumptions are the hardest to uncover. Those are the assumptions that are so much a part of who we are and the way that we look at our practice, that when someone says, oh, well, actually, that's an assumption that you're operating under, we typically say, no, that's reality. That's the way the world is. One of my paradigmatic assumptions that it was very hard for me to challenge was something I was very socialized into in graduate school. Adults are self-directed learners. If you take that as a defining assumption for how you approach being an adult educator, then your whole practice is focused on getting out of the way to allow people to exercise their own authority and control, which I do feel is very appropriate in some situations, but I've understood in other ways is very contextually problematic. For example, a lot of the colleagues that I work with in Minnesota, I work at a predominantly white university, and a lot of the work that I do is around uncovering racial microaggressions in whites, and typically I get a lot of people who give strong pushback and say we don't want to do this, you're seeing race where race doesn't exist and so on. So if I allowed them to self-directedly determine which particular leadership project they wanted to engage in, the last thing they would do would be to examine their own behavior for evidence of racial microaggressions. Say more about that notion in a minute. Here's a professional example I've already mentioned of, I think, ways in which assumptions can be looked at differently. I was one of those who in grad school was basically socialized into the circle. And, you know, the first thing I did as a beginning adult educator was to get to the adult ed center early and arrange the chairs in a circle and feel really good about that, that I was, you know, a democratic student-centered educator. Carl Rogers or John Dewey were channeling through me, and I was just a really, you know, a really good guy. And the students would love my humanity, and they would love feeling that they were in an environment where now their experience was respected. But it's interesting, autobiographically, I would then go to graduate school in the evening, and I'd walk into a room and I'd see the chairs in a circle, and I'd think, oh God, no, not a circle again. Please, why can't you let me just sit at the back and listen and think? And then when I'm ready, I'll move into the circle. Don't coerce me into mandatory speech. I didn't know about Foucault's notion of confessional practices when this happened. But, you know, I knew that in the circle, I was supposed to talk about my experience and the way in which being in graduate school had helped me move beyond my distorted understandings of practice and come to a clearer perspective on the field. So it's interesting, when I've done critical incident questionnaires on how students feel about the circle, sometimes it works great if certain conditions are in place. But sometimes it feels like surveillance, because now in the circle everybody can see me, and I don't have the chance to ask a colleague in the back row, what did he mean by that? Now if I want to ask what did he mean by that, everybody will see me asking what did he mean by that. And I will therefore be shamed. And I'm now expected to speak. And now that I'm in a circle, I don't have the right to silence. So it was interesting for me to read that and then to come across a great book by a woman called Jennifer Gore, G-O-R-E. The book is called The Struggle for Pedagogy. And she takes Foucault's work and applies it to a lot of very familiar practices in adult education, one of which is the circle. And she says that for students who feel that they don't lack the proper language of academia, or that something about them marks them out as different, the way they look, the way they sound, the circle can be a really excruciating experience, of excruciating form of surveillance. So now, when I use the circle, I do so by telling students you don't have to speak in the circle. The reason I'm using the circle is so that we can have good sight lines, and that if somebody does want to participate, they don't have to reach over the backs of others and catch my attention. But I won't assume that if you don't speak, you're disengaged or not committed. I just assume this is the way that you learn, by a lot of mulling over. And conversely, those who speak, I won't assume that you're more diligent or smarter. I'll just assume you are someone who learns by verbal processing. And there are a lot of people who learn by talking things out. In my marriage, my wife is one who learns by talking things out. And I'm one who learns by silent thinking. And I'm not quite sure why you're laughing about that. But
it's a joke.
So, let's look at another example, visiting groups. When I began teaching and I would set small groups, I would always go around the room and sit by or hover meaningfully close to a group just to be there so that if they needed my help, they could call me in and I could deal with questions. And I felt that was an example of responsive student-centered teaching. Then I started systematically researching my classes, and I realized that in some situations, groups felt that, again, as a surveillance tool, that the closer that I got to them, the more they stopped doing what they were doing and switched into a performative mode of being a good group, a good task-oriented group, which, heaven help us, there is no silence, no just thinking quietly and struggling with something. When I got there, they said, they felt they had to be on task and speaking articulately and look smart. And then I move on and they go back to hesitations, pauses, all the things that you really need to make sense of complex material. And I've certainly felt that autobiographically. And then the work on the way that groups develop their own norms very much supports that a visiting authority can really get in the way of the necessary development of culture that groups need when members are feeling each other out. This is something that's really helped me in this regard, the critical incident questionnaire. This is a 5-item a response tool that I use once a week in all my classes. I'm using it also once a week right now in my fully online course that I teach. There are five questions. What was the moment in class you were most engaged as a participant this week? Moment in class you were most distanced. What action that anyone took was most helpful? Action that anyone took was most puzzling, and what surprised you most? If you want to download the form, it's up on my homepage. Just go to stephenbrookfield.com and there is a link to this form, Critical Incident Questionnaire, and case studies of how people have used it. It's the last item of business. It's anonymous. I've used it, by the way, as a meeting evaluation tool when I've been head of department. So at the end of every bi-weekly staff meeting, my staff fills out the same five questions about the meeting. And I never read through them when I'm department chair. A different member of my staff collects the responses each week, summarizes them, and then at the start of the next meeting, that member of staff gives the report. What I do is look for themes that are mentioned by at least 10% of the students, and then I report them out and talk about how this has influenced what I'm doing in class the next week. I think that doing this models critical thinking, because I'm showing people constantly that I'm checking whether or not the assumptions that I'm operating under and the way that I've set up the course, running the class, I'm checking whether those are accurate or not. It's a great early warning device. Since I started using it, I've never had a work team or a group of students blow up unexpectedly in mutiny. I've always known that the resistance was there and had some sense of, hopefully, how to deal with it. It very nicely illustrates diversity in a class or team, because when you report out the results and you say the same moment in class or the same moment in a meeting produced completely antithetical responses. Some felt it was the most engaged moment for this reason, or the most helpful part of the meeting for those reasons. And others feel the exact same thing was the most distancing part of class and the most puzzling part. That allows me then to say to my team or to my students, this is why I won't only do one thing in class. This is why I feel as a teacher my responsibility is to use multiple modalities, never to do just one instructional approach, because you all learn differently. It's a nice way for me to introduce the notion of diversity of learning preference and style. And then I view this as negotiation, not capitulation. In other words, sometimes I get feedback from a group which says something like, enough with the critical thinking, tell us the right way to think, what's the correct answer? And I'll say, I'm not going to do that. If I do that, then really there's no point in me showing up for work, because my job is to help you to get you to think critically. Maybe we can negotiate about how I'm doing it, but I'm not going to tell you the answer. I'm going to require you to struggle with it and come to your own judgments here. What I do have to do is re-justify why I won't budge and re-explain why I won't budge. I think when we're critically reflective, what I've noticed is we find a couple of interesting things. Number one, we become much more attuned to power and the fact that in every classroom, in every meeting, power dynamics are in play. We become, I think, more aware of how our own power as leaders or as teachers is used in a responsible and ethical way. One of the most intriguing things I've been thinking about lately is from a guy called Ian Baptiste at Penn State University. I talked with him a few times in Chicago, and he has a whole pedagogy of ethical coercion. Where he says, we do coerce students to do things. We do require them to do things. We don't call it coercion, but we're really using our authority to require students to do this. So, I have things like a circle of voices exercise, which is designed to democratize the class early on and to create an opportunity for everybody to speak. And I don't allow students to pass in that exercise. Because if I allow students to pass, those who pass will be the ones who have the least power, typically, outside of the classroom. So all I'm doing is reproducing power relations inside. But in order to make them feel as comfortable as possible, Circle of Voices starts with a mandatory 2-minute silence. Again, I'm using my power to coerce people into silence, to force the extroverts to be silent, so that the introverts can mull over, or people whose English is not their first language can sort of translate what they want to say into English. The other thing you find is you become much more aware of hegemonic assumptions. A hegemonic assumption is the assumption that we hold as practitioners that we feel is good and works for us and is common sense. In fact, though, if we could just step out of our frame of reference and look back, we see that these assumptions are killing us softly, to use the Fugees song title of many years ago, or the Roberta Flack version of many, many, many years ago, for those of us of a certain generation. A good example of a hegemonic assumption for me is the notion that education is a vocation. When I went into adult education and I started working in community colleges, colleges of further education, as they were called in England, I remember colleagues of mine who, going into industry, saying, you know, I'm going to be earning this much by the time I'm 30, I'm buying a new car, next month. Unimaginable riches for me. But I would say to myself, well, okay, you want to sell your soul to mammon, that's fine, but I'm retaining my purity, and I'm going to education, and I'm serving my vocation of working with adult students that the system up to now has dismissed and disenfranchised. So I embrace very strongly this education as vocation notion, which I believe in. Unfortunately, what happens is that institutions are then able to take your vocational commitment and exploit you. So, someone would come to me and say, well, can you take on this extra section of students? Can you add this course? So-and-so is on sabbatical. Can you take over their responsibilities? Will you chair this task force? And if all they needed to say was, doing this will really help students. And they'd suckered me in, and they'd really caught me. So I got to a point where I only thought I'd done a good day's work if, at the end of the day, I was so completely fried, completely wasted, had no energy left for anything, other than watching a rerun of NCIS or something like that, or The Listener, to use a Canadian series. And it wasn't like I was fighting against being exploited. I was embracing this. The more tired I felt, the prouder I felt. I'm a really good adult educator, because look how tired I am. So, and you know, just personally, over the last 15, 20 years, I've had 3 collapses, once at an airport, passing out, that is, once in my office, once at the airport, and once I could feel it coming on the freeway after a workshop, and I had to pull over and enter in the car. And was rushed to the emergency room, multiple tests, each time absolutely nothing going on, other than exhaustion. So, for me, critical reflection is very good at alerting us to these kind of assumptions that we embrace, but that are harming us. And I think also what we find when you look at how people develop critical reflection themselves is that when we model it to our students and to our colleagues, this is the most effective way often to teach it. I feel that before you're asking anybody to think critically or act reflectively, you have to do it first publicly. Earn the right to ask them to do this by very publicly and intentionally saying, this is how I engage in critical reflection about my assumptions. This is how I'm trying to understand what my assumptions are and to check them out by looking at them from different perspectives. And I think that when we model a willingness to live with diversity, which I think is very well done when you do team teaching across racial group memberships, or team teaching with people from other occupational backgrounds, or team teaching where people with different disciplinary or ideological bents are on the team with you, and you illustrate the way that you live with that, you strive to understand it, don't always seek to come to consensus, but work out ways of living with that complexity and diversity. That's a very good way to model these things for students. So I wanted to kind of finish off my formal remarks by giving an extended example of critical reflection in practice, which is the first speech that I typically used to give to students when I met them for the first time in a class, or the first speech that I give to a team when I was the first time I was working with them as a team leader. So I'd get to class early, I'd arrange chairs in a circle, as I mentioned already. Students would come in and I'd say things on the screen. Please call me Stephen. I'd like us to be on first name terms here. I'd like to call you by your first names. Let's make this a relaxed and congenial environment for learning. This is not like school. You know, this is adult education, or we're in college now. We do things differently here. And I say, you know, I love to teach this class. One of the reasons why I love working with you is that you bring such rich experience, skills, and knowledge that I learn as much from you as you will learn from me. I think it's a real privilege to get paid to do this work because I'm going to learn so much from you. And you may think that I'm the teacher and I know everything and you're the learners who are all novices, but it's not how it is. You all have skills and knowledge and experience that even if they haven't been developed in relation to this particular subject or this particular course, I guarantee you have skills and knowledge and experience that you can bring into the classroom from other areas of your life that will really help you understand how to do this better. And then I would say there's three things I want you to know about how I like to run my class. Number one, I really welcome questions. Anyone has a question, shout it out. There is no such thing as a dumb or stupid question in my class. If you think your question is a daft question, I guarantee you there will be one or two other people who have exactly the same question but don't have the nerve to raise it. So you'll be doing them a favor. So please, any questions, I really, really welcome them. And then I say, but you know, sometimes you'll ask me a question, I won't have the answer right then and there on the tip of my tongue or the tip of my fingers. But if I don't have the answer, I promise you I will find out. And next week, or on Blackboard tonight, I'll post the answer. And I would also say, you know, when you do ask me a question that I don't have the answer for, you're actually doing me a big favor, because you're giving me a little learning project. And part of being a teacher is constantly updating your knowledge and learning new things. So when you ask me a question I don't know the answer, I want to thank you for that gift, really, that you're giving me of a new learning project. Then I would say mistakes. Mistakes are the best moments in learning. You know, doing things well is great and is important, but the only way you really move forward is by understanding why you've made a particular mistake. And thinking through, how can I avoid making a similar mistake in the future? So when you make a mistake in this class, don't do maybe what you did in high school, which is feel embarrassed and ashamed and try and keep the mistake private. Bring it out into the open. Let us all know so we can learn along with you from the mistake. And, you know, I'm a teacher, but I still make mistakes. The last time I taught this class, I made two mistakes that really helped me be a better teacher for you this time round. And then I finished by saying, finally, I've planned my course very carefully, put a lot of forethought into it, but one thing I know, sooner or later, Something unexpected is going to happen in class. When this unexpected event happens, I don't want you to look to me for the answer. We, as a learning community, are going to figure out how to deal with anything unexpected that suddenly arises in class. So I would say this, and I think, you know, I'm just, again, a very democratic, student-centered educator. I'm really doing a great job. I'm respectful. I'm inviting full collaboration. I'm creating an environment that encourages risk-taking, you know, my emphasis on mistakes, and people warming to my humanity. So then I start asking students, I did this in about 1990 when I was writing a book called The Skillful Teacher, which I think is on here for raffle, and got to meet together as many students I've worked with in the previous decade and asked them what were the best and worst moments in class with me. And so many people said the first class, when you made a speech that made us feel incredibly anxious and think maybe I should get down to the registrar's office and register for a different section because it doesn't look like I'm going to learn anything valuable or worthwhile in this section. So, these are what they thought. I'm a psychologically needy, incompetent. My lack of expertise is making them very nervous. So I'm coming in almost apologising for being there, talking about the mistakes that I've made, saying that if you ask me questions, I won't always have the answer for them. And then one of the best comments, you know, okay, if you haven't learned as much from us as we're going to learn from you, how about we split tuition, one student said. And, you know, when the unexpected problem does emerge, I'll be clueless to know what to do. So this really hit me, this feedback, because that speech that I made, I absolutely believe 100% in. But it seems that the speech, when employed with a group of people who know nothing about me, who are novices in a new area, who have no sense of my credibility, have no confidence in my ability, because they just don't know who I am. The one thing they know is that they don't know how to do A, B, or C. Then the speech can easily backfire in a way that completely took me by surprise. So now, when I'm going to teach a new class, I always play a mental game with myself. I imagine that instead of being the teacher going to teach the course, I'm a student showing up at the first day of class, and I try and say, okay, what would I want to hear, what would I want to happen the first day if I know I know nothing about these skills, I'm nervous, I'm feeling like, you know, a complete imposter as a student, I'm never going to get it. And the example I always think of is learning to do whitewater rafting. My wife, who is Minnesotan, which abuts Canada, like I think Minnesotans and Canadians, have an annoying outdoor streak in their personality. So they're always trying to get out, doing things outdoors. I discovered the great indoors when I was about 18. So she's been trying to get me to go wildwood rafting for many years, and I've agreed, and next summer we will go to Utah. I think it's, is it the Green River? Anyway, we're going to Moab, and we're doing a 10-day wildwood rafting class. So let's assume then in the spring I enroll in Minnesota for a training course on how to do this, and I'm waiting there. First day of class. I'm nervous. I'm seeing the raft go like that, thinking that's not good, shouldn't it be stable? I'm hearing rapids churning, and I'm thinking, oh man, I'm going to get in the raft, we'll go in the rapids, I'll fall out, my head will hit a rock, I'll pass out, my leg will get caught under a tree root, and I'll die. So learning equals death, basically. That's a big, big price to pay. And then the instructor comes from the Pines. Lacina also, Lana, to be gender correct. So Lacina comes over and she says, "Hi guys, welcome to Whitewater Rafting 101. You know, I love teaching this course. Please call me Lacina. Call me Lassie. I want this to be a congenial, relaxed environment for learning." And she says, "You know, I love teaching the course because I learn so much from you. You bring so many experiences, knowledge, and skills. And you may feel you know nothing about why it was. But trust me, you have learned new things in your life outside, which will be really helpful to you when you're learning the skills associated with rafting. Like, you've all had to deal with moments of crisis in a very short period of time, right? And make a decision when you didn't know what the right thing to do was. Well, that skill will be really helpful when we're going through the rapids." And then she says, "So it's a privilege to get paid, because I'll learn so much from you." And then she says, "Let me say a little bit about how I want to run the class. Number one, I really welcome questions. So when we're on the river, if you have any questions, shout them out, and I'll do my best to respond to them. There's no such thing as a dumb question. If you think it's a daft question, I guarantee it'll be someone else in the raft who has the same question. You're doing them a favor. But sometimes you'll ask me a question, and I actually won't have the answer right there on my tip of my tongue or fingers. But I do promise you, if that's true, I will find out the answer and get back to you by next week's class." And she says, "And by the way, when you ask me a question I don't have the answer for, you're giving me a wonderful gift of a new learning project. Because as a teacher, I'm always learning new things. So thank you in advance for the gift of unanswerable questions that you've been giving me." And then she says, "Let me say something about mistakes. Mistakes are the richest moments in your learning autobiography. You learn way more from a mistake properly analyzed than from a success. So when you make a mistake in this course, don't try and hide it and feel ashamed and keep it private. Bring it out into the open so we can all learn along with you as you're kind of deconstructing your mistake." And just to emphasize the importance of mistakes, I'm a teacher, but you know, the last time I taught this class, I made two basic mistakes that really helped me be a better teacher for this group this time around. And then she says, "One final thing. I planned this course very carefully, given it a lot of forethought, but I know from experience, sooner or later, something unexpected is going to happen. So it'll take us all by surprise. When that unexpected moment comes, I don't want you to look to me for the answer. We, as a learning community, who all bring skills, knowledge, and experience, we are going to work out how to deal with the unexpected event." And so, she says, "What I'd like us to do as we're drifting towards the rapids, I'd like you to form into trios in the raft, hit some magic, waterproof newsprint and some waterproof magic markers. I'd like you in trios to brainstorm the ways that you deal with crisis in your life and the top strategies that you feel work best. Put them on the newsprint, and as we're going towards the rapids, we'll do a sort of tour and gallery of the responses, and based on those, we'll decide how best to negotiate the rapids that are coming up." So that's basically the example I keep in my head as I'm going to teach a new course full of novices who know nothing about me. And although I believe completely in the speech that I said earlier, I just feel that my assumption that this is a generically transferable way of reducing students' anxiety is very, very questionable. It really depends on the context within which you're working. So when I work with different groups of adults, couple of months ago I was down at the Marine Corps headquarters in Quantico, and then I've worked with the Occupy movement in the States. When I'm brought into a different setting, I don't say anything like a speech, although I absolutely believe it. What I try and do early on is establish some experiential credibility so that they can have trust that this person who's brought in actually has a sense of what people are dealing with. So anyway, those are my opening remarks, and if you want to follow any of this up, we have the homepage up there and some books. And I think we're going to have a raffle now. And while that's going on, I'm just going to pull up today's Meet and also Twitter and see what's on there. And then we'll meet in a few minutes and chat about this.
Raised typically.
particularly in class, where people are understandably nervous about how their question is going to be received by me and by their peers. Let's have a look at the Twitter feed. Some how many teachers does it take to change a light bulb? I'm not sure. Certainly takes two to conduct a raffle. Unanswerable questions are gifts for teachers. Yes, and I do believe that. You know, I absolutely believe that. Is there a goal to critical reflection, an end state? Often we replace one assumption with another, and for me there is no goal, there is no end state. The book I wrote about that, this is called Becoming a Critically Reflective Teacher, and I do believe, in a Rogerian sense, it's a process continually of becoming. I'll be revising that book in 2015, and so I don't ever feel I've reached a state of being a fully developed, critically reflective practitioner at all. It's a constant process of checking assumptions, and maybe you get better at reading different contexts and reading cues, but absolutely no end goal, no certificate at the end of it. Thank you, Stephen. Thanks, Bill. Do hegemonic assumptions equal core beliefs? I think that they do. In many ways, they are our core beliefs. Although that's not the totality of a hegemonic assumption, because you can have a core belief which is extremely liberating and which secures your political and mental health, or keeps the chances of political and mental health being more intact. So a hegemonic assumption, I suppose, is a core belief that is self-injurious, that damages you and that serves the interests of someone else. Other core beliefs protect you. Which sources have the most power in trying to unseat assumptions? What's most effective? Well, if you look at literature on transformative learning, what seems to be most effective is what Jack Mesereau calls a disorienting dilemma. In other words, putting people in a situation where their standard ways of thinking and reacting are suddenly upended and they don't know what to do. I think this happens. This happened when I was fired at age 31. It really reframed my assumptions about organizational loyalty. I felt that, you know, if you were organizationally loyal, worked hard, and so on, that you wouldn't be treated badly. Shows how naive I was at that point. And I regard myself as someone who's come up through critical theory and had a bit of political intelligence, but being fired was an incredible disorienting dilemma to me. So it seems that experientially, having something unexpected happen to us, which just kind of knocks us off balance, that's the most effective trigger, which is tough in an educational situation, because if you get a reputation as a teacher who constantly knocks students off balance, you know, if there's any elective element to your courses, no one is going to sign up for that, maybe because they don't feel they want to sign up for pain or threat. You know, what people want to sign up for is to feel often better and good about what they do. So I think in an educational context, you have to engineer, just enough disorientation to move people out of their zone of comfort. It's kind of Vygotskian notion. But you have to support that by a lot of modeling and by a lot of risk-taking yourself. So you show students that you're willing to engage in some critical reflection, let's say by inviting a colleague into class who thinks completely different from you, and then having a constructive conversation with them where you try and explore each other's differences. So some of the best critical reflection I think I've been involved with has been in multiracial teaching teams where we, as the members of the teaching team, talk out loud the different ways that our racial group memberships and our cultural traditions frame how we took decisions as a teaching team. And then, having done that, move to asking the students. Or if I want white colleagues to be more aware of racial microaggressions, the small daily acts of exclusion that whites engage in, tone of voice, gesture, who you invite to call, how you look at different people, who you notice in class, examples you use. If I'm trying to get colleagues to consider that notion seriously, I absolutely have to make myself the initial object of analysis and talk about the microaggressions I've engaged in the last few days or in the last few weeks. Let's just take the last ones and then we'll open this out. I think that was the last actual question. So we have a couple of mics, right? If anyone needs them. So I'd just like to open this out for reactions, questions, disagreements.
Okay, I think my voice can project. Okay. So I was curious about how we overcome those assumptions that are embedded in the college culture. So in our own advertisements and even in our departments where technical skills are valued and even prioritized over, you know, the actual learning experience.
Yes. Well, I think one way is to bring in, and I'm sure that a lot of people do this, people who are working in the arena in which you're teaching students, bring them in and ask them to talk about the best and worst days that they've had as workers. And I think a lot of what those practitioners will talk about has to do with managing emotional ups and downs, with feeling hurt and abused by a stupid an unresponsible exercise of power on us, or feeling really good about what happened because you just felt you'd made a real contribution, something like that. So I feel that in a skills-oriented course, and I have to teach a lot of skills-oriented courses in my life, taught a lot of study skills to pre-college students, for example. What I would do with those students would bring in current college students and ask them to pass on the best advice that they could to the new students who were studying to get into college. And it was interesting that the adults who came back, who now were in an undergraduate degree, would talk mostly about emotional survival rather than, well, you must make sure you use this particular method of note-taking, let's say. They would say, you know, the thing that will get you through your first year is having two or three other people who form a kind of reference group or network or community so that when you wake up at 3 a.m. in a cold panic because you've got to do this thing in class next day, there's someone you know that if need be you could call them up. And after they grumbled about being woken up, they would talk you down. Or you'd ring them up and find out that they were awake as well, similarly fretting about the next day. So I think, this is autobiographically true for me, you know, the days that I remember as my best days as a teacher aren't because, you know, I explained concept better that day than I'd ever explained it before. It usually has to do because I can see that some students are really finally getting it, and that suffuses me with a warm emotional glow, and I feel I'm earning my money here. So the whole emotional dimension to professional life is really, I think, important to for us to bring into any kind of professional training.
17-year-olds and 18-year-olds in class that it's appropriate to use the principles of adult education. We know that 17 and 18-year-olds, in fact, are halfway through adolescence.
Yeah.
The developmental psychology book I use says we hit adulthood around 24, 25. Apparently in California, adolescence now stretches to 35. And so it's fundamentally flawed that you have 50 18-year-olds in your class and you're following pedagogy of adult education. It makes no sense. It's endlessly frustrating.
Interesting. I mean, I would feel also that just because someone is chronologically age 25, developmentally, doesn't mean that they're adult. Or they're chronologically age 55 or 85, developmentally. Now, if we think that adult development involves, for example, an ability to think dialectically, to hold two opposite ideas in tension, and not to be fazed by that, and to say, when we look at the interchange between these two ideas, we can get some kind of contextual synthesis and move forward. That's often claimed to be an adult, form of adult cognition. Well, I know this is being recorded, so I have to be careful who I quote here, but there are people that I'm very close to who absolutely are unable to do that, who are older than I. And the fact that they have spent multiple years on the planet has not meant they are able to think more contextually or to hold contrasting ideas in a congenial tension. So although age, I think, is an important variable, and yes, the developmental literature says that, you know, students, 17, 18, the whole notion of multiplicity thinking is very difficult. It's hard for them to move to what Perry calls a position of informed commitment, where you declare a belief and a trust in a piece of knowledge or an action, and yet also know that you might change your mind based on experience in the future. You know, getting to that point is usually, in Perry's work, is something more that happens in the early 20s, and he was looking mostly at Harvard undergrads. So, but I guess I would disagree with the idea that adult educational approaches don't work with that group, because I mean, I've seen middle school teachers run participatory discussions in which are deliberately inclusive and democratic, and which develop organically, so that people are constantly synthesizing and building on each other's responses. So, you know, I've seen that happen in public schools in Minneapolis, where I visited, in middle schools. And I've seen doctoral seminars, which are just basically emotional battlegrounds, where people are trying to outsmart and win brownie points and sound more esoterically, you know, jargon-filled than someone else. So I kind of have moved to a position of thinking that good instruction is very contextual, but that potentially any method is appropriate in any particular situation. It all depends on who you're dealing with, what you find when you get there. I don't think that any one method is inherently adult. I don't think holding a discussion is an inherently adult way of working. Because discussions can be emotionally manipulative battlegrounds in which the usual suspects ride roughshod over anybody else, and discussions can enforce bigotry and entrench beliefs, not explode them. And I don't believe that lectures are inherently authoritarian and passivity-inducing. You can lecture, as Freire said, and people often think Freire was critical of lectures. Actually, Freire says a lecture can be a critical posing of an alternative reality to someone, can really explode them out of a settled framework. And I also feel lectures can be very interactive. You know, so for me, the question really is, what worked with that particular group at that particular time in terms of what you're trying to get towards. It's a very pragmatic way that I personally think about education. Pragmatism in the good sense. American pragmatism, kind of Dewey, Emerson, define pragmatism as the experimental pursuit of beautiful consequences. And a beautiful consequence to me is as close to a fully democratic, inclusive environment as I can create in a team or in a classroom. And I feel that the way that I get there is very, very experimental. There's no roadmap to it. Yes, at the back.
Some of your anecdotes, and I'm trying to think how to frame this question. You've dealt a couple of times with disruption of hegemonic assumptions, how they like to address questions of race and presumably gender, class, ability. How can one do that? I mean, I'm speaking to you maybe as a white man.
Yeah.
How can you do that without being disingenuous? Because I like to do that, but I don't like, as a privileged white woman, I'm concerned that that's how I might come off.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first thing you have to avoid doing is apologizing for who you are. So I'm proud of who I am. You know, I'm who I am. I support Alton Wanderers. I come from Bootle in Liverpool. I'm very proud of my background. And so what I have to be upfront about is this is my location, this is my identity. But given that identity, I have to be willing to examine how I internalized elements of dominant ideology, using critical theory terms, like the ideology of white supremacy, or the ideology of patriarchy. Patriarchy's really got its hooks into me, and I'm never going to shake it. Patriarchy being, as I understand it, the ideology which says that men should be entrusted with decision-making, authority, and power because they are the ones who have the greatest rational faculties and are able to think objectively compared to women who tend to be governed by unreliable emotions and compassion. Men of the pure light of reason. It's not going to be swayed by that. Now, if you said to me, patriarchy is living within me, I say that. I mean, one part of me say that's crazy. I'm way, way beyond that. But two examples, one humorous, one not. When I'm with my wife, a very, very common pattern, and we've been together since 1982, is that we get into a dispute, and I hear myself saying to Kim, well, when you calm down, we can talk about this, but I'm really not going to waste my energy in a shouting match. You just need to calm down, and then we'll talk. And it's like pouring gasoline onto a fire, obviously. So that's one thing. But the more serious, well, that is serious, obviously. The other thing that occurs to me is, I'm one of the, I don't know how many there are in Canada, but in the States, 20, 22 million diagnosed with clinical depression. So I suffer from clinical depression. And for many years, I refused to get any help. And I thought that taking medications was a sign of my personal failure and weakness, and I felt very ashamed because I had nothing to be depressed about. And I think the reason why I didn't get help for so many years was because what I would say to myself is, well, look, you've got nothing to be depressed about, so snap out of it. Come on, snap out of it, which is the worst thing you can say to someone. Because if depression truly is a chemical imbalance in the brain, then the power of reason to tell yourself to snap out of it means nothing. But because I had this notion that men are superior, rational, thinking beings, that was the immediate response to depression that I rushed to. And I remember thinking and saying to my wife, hey, meds are not for me. The only people I knew who were taking medication for depression were women. Not a single male in all my contacts across the world that I knew who had depression or was on medication. So I had no model of a male doing this. So I think once I realized that a lot of my resistance to dealing with this came from an embedded ideology of patriarchy that had really got its hooks into me, then I was able to feel much better about taking medication and seeking help. And now I'm on a permanent meds. I'll be on for the rest of my life, which are terrific and work really, really well, other than putting on about 60 pounds, unfortunately. But that's, I'd rather have that than how things used to be. So, you know, I think when we're trying to teach how dominant ideology operates, we have to use our own autobiographies and our own narratives as one of the main teaching tools. So you don't come in and say to the group, now we're going to look at dominant ideology, we're going to look at ableism, we're going to look at heterosexism, we're going to look at white supremacy, we're going to look at patriarchy. I mean, I personally feel instead what you do is come in and say, here's how I'm living this, and here's how this element of theory has helped me understand it better. And then if you have done that genuinely, then I think you can turn to a group and say, now let's start looking at the way these things maybe live, you live out these things and they operate in your own lives. But I also know, in terms of my own identity, that I can use narrative disclosure and talk about things that have happened to me. And I get a lot of approval for it. So if I go in a class and I talk about some mistakes I've made or errors that I've committed, typically the evaluations will say, oh, isn't it great that Stephen is still willing to own up to mistakes? Isn't this a wonderful vulnerability? I work with junior female colleagues of color, and they own up to a mistake or an error, and the feedback is, why are you foisting, why is affirmative action foisting unqualified incompetence on us? So I believe, another reason for team teaching, that it's good for me to teach with someone like that and for us to problematize the power dynamics between us and for me to try and make myself the object of analysis and then use that as a teaching demonstration for the group. That's kind of where I am on that. But it could also be seen as incredibly self-indulgent, and you're always talking about yourself. You know, that's the drawback of this. It's a very thin line that you walk. I don't think that really addressed your question, though. Do you want to come back on?
Sorry? Actually, it sort of did and it sort of didn't. One of the things I found useful from your reading in the past, particularly from Skilled Teacher, was the anecdotes that you shared, because probably being that kind of a learner, I'll take from it what I need. So if you feel like giving a few more, that would be helpful. But that's what I'm looking for. I'm just looking for what it did look like when you were addressing it. Because it does come up, I teach nursing here, and it does come up that we deal with things like horizontal violence, which is oppressed group behavior.
Yeah.
And it is something that would be good to deal with from that critical theory, from a feminist standpoint, looking at it as an issue that's bigger than just, you know, women being bitchy in the workplace. But again, I have to be mindful, I think, of the fact that this has not been my personal lived experience.
Yes.
But I do see that a lot of my students, that will be theirs.
Yes. I do also feel, I've just finished a book called Engaging Imagination, which is coming out early next year, which looks primarily at non-text-based modes of teaching. And I'm particularly interested in the use of film. So if there are filmic or televisual depictions of scenarios, which we can ask students, what what do you think is in so-and-so's head? What's the justification for why they behaved in that particular way? That seems to be a relatively non-threatening way of bringing people into a discussion of extremely contentious and personal issues, because the film is clearly a fictional construct. But if you're skillful at the way you run the analysis of the film, you can then hopefully make a link between the dynamics that we've seen revealed in this film and people's own individual situations. But yes, you have to be upfront that you have not lived, and you can have no awareness of what it feels like, for me, to be the victim of ongoing institutional racism. I know theoretically what this is, but I have no experiential knowledge about that. But that doesn't mean to say that I can't look at it and try and understand it, but I just have to avoid saying, well, yeah, I grew up in a very working class area of Liverpool, so I kind of get what discrimination is, because the way that I used to speak, people would laugh at me when I moved south, and assume that that is equivalent to ongoing racism, because it's nowhere near it. So I think just being open about your location and not trying to convince people that you are an ally who understands horizontal violence or whatever it is. Coming across and saying, I'm your ally, well, it's just, that's, you're dead in the water, I think, if you do that. Now, if someone says to you, I see you as an ally, that's wonderful, but no way do you go in. There's a group called the European Collective Challenging Whiteness in San Francisco, which has been looking at the way whites try and engage in anti-racist work for about 15 years. And one of the major problems that they identify, one is preaching and the other is disdaining. So as a white, you disdain other whites who have less racial cognizance than you. And then you end up preaching to them, you need to be enlightened in the way that I am. So here's the article by Peggy McIntosh on white privilege. Go and read it, and aren't I giving you a wonderful gift of self-awareness? And, you know, that's a big, big dynamic to avoid. How are we doing for time?
You know what, we're kind of at 2:28, which is 2 minutes away from when we said we would finish.
Okay.
So it might mean that it's time to draw for 3 more books. And then what we're proposing is that those of you who have brought, one more question, can it be answered in 90 seconds?
I just want to follow up on what you were talking
sure.
about.
Sure.
Just quickly, I love your story about the speech, the first speech. I tried that for many, many years.
Yes.
One response to it was a student, after 2 classes, went and asked to be removed from my class and never come to any courses I teach.
Yes.
The lesson for me. The conversation and your response were really illuminating a moment ago. What I want to ask you about is, for instance, myself as a racialized teacher, as a leftist feminist in my classroom with my white male students, a few of them,
yeah.
who would question
yeah.
my qualifications to be a teacher
yes.
in that space. And that's that power that
Absolutely.
Operates.
Yeah.
It's not a position of power, obviously, but it's a power that's historically strengthened, that sits in my back. And through that, either the verbal or the non-verbal messages that is carried out there, it makes it a very emotional space for me, a very problematic space for me, and speaks volume to the classroom as a contested space
Absolutely.
From so many angles.
Yeah.
With your collegial approach to teaching, whether this has been a question has been raised.
I mean, I think what you say is absolutely true, that, again, I can have no experiential awareness. I mean, I can rationally know what you're talking to me, but you're working with white students, and as soon as you walk into the room, you have been dismissed as soon as they see it before you even opened your mouth. because of a learned ideology of white supremacy. It's not usually called as such, but that's what does it. So I think, for me, this is why multiracial teaching teams, I'm so interested in exploring that dynamic. Because I think it's easier, if you and I were in the room together, for us to raise and problematize that, than it is for you to problematize it to a majority white group who are going to see you as pushing an agenda and creating a clear divide between you. If the two of us are talking about it, my hope would be this invites people into a conversation. And if I particularly talk out my own learned instincts, that when I see a person of color come into a classroom, all my reasoning and decades of immersion in critical theory and reading from different racial traditions is like a candle flickering against a tsunami of learned ideology. So I would be talking about my response to you. And my hope would be that that would then legitimize and create an opening to bring those students in. For them to talk about and look a little bit more critically at their own immediate emotional responses when they saw you come into the room. So, if President Obama called me in and said, I'm the czar of higher education and I have unlimited money to do whatever I wanted to do, my first act in the United States would be to mandate that all courses are team taught, unless there's a strong reason why that shouldn't be the case. And that wherever possible, when we're seeking to educate students to live in a diverse world, and not always seek artificial compromise, we need to have multiracial teaching teams as a norm. So that's what we're about. I am going to be speaking again.
At 4 p.m.
At 4 p.m.
In this room.
It won't be the same.
Hold on. Oh, sorry, after that. Okay.
One more.
There you go.
All right, how many? Three?
Three. Yes, three. Okay, the first one is 271. 271. 271, yay, Norman. 305. 305, yay! And 197. Karen, did you win?
305?
305. Yes, there you go. Wonderful. Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, one moment.
Thank you very much.